Hey, Bob Hoover, you have flown a lot of these airplanes, including a lot of the German airplanes. What was the best one you got to fly of the World War II airplanes?
Well, I had the opportunity and the privilege of flying everything in the Allied forces before I went into combat the second time. And I chose Spitfires because I wasn't thinking in terms of long range. I was thinking of the ability to dogfight, to turn as tight as you could and get inside the enemy airplanes. I would like to jump to the thing that Gunther talked about. I had the privilege again to fly the captured airplanes after War II. Most of your airplanes, even the Heinkel 162 jet, and most of the Japanese airplanes. And we did just what you had done during the war, evaluating one against the other. And the last flight I had in a 109, I was flying the Confederate Air Force airplane in a mock dogfight. And Gabby Gabreski was on the microphone when I walked in the officers club. And he said, but Gabby and I were in the same prison camp. And Gabby said, Bob, you've just been flying the 109. Come on up here on stage. I want you to tell us about it. And I said, well, I've flown it before a few times, but Gabby, you had 38 kills, and I'm so proud of you, but you should have had 138. And Gunther, everything you talked about the airplane is true. When the radiators would go down automatically, you'd be on the target, and the airplane would start doing this, and it'd start doing this. And you were blind. Down here, you couldn't see anything. Your head was about like this, and you couldn't see anything behind you. And I'm dead serious. I think we really had the advantage on you when it came to the 109. Now, the Focke-Wulf 190, that was another ball game. And it was some kind of a real airplane. And it proved itself.
Bob, when you were shot down and you were in a prisoner of war camp for what, 15, 16 months?
15 months, and your CO, Hub Zimke, was the commander in that particular camp. And he always said that he had entered a thunderstorm and it tore the wings off. Do you suppose that's true?
I have no comment.
Well, Hub.
What'd you say, Shorty?
I said, I have no comment. I was not on that mission. I've flown a 51. I know this. Get my group commander, Hub Zimke, was not the greatest instrument pilot. I do know that. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Well,
in the camp, how did you manage to escape from that camp?
I've been given a lot of credit for that, and I wish you to know that the Germans were deserting. The Russians were so close to our camp, they were about 100 miles away with big cannons, and we could hear them. And the German guards started deserting their posts. And I looked out one day, and I saw a lot of missing guards around the perimeter. In the last 6 months of the war, General Eisenhower had issued an edict for all pilot briefings that no one was to attempt escape. But I had spent a whole year before that, dreaming and doing nothing but attempting to escape. And I spent a lot of time in solitary, and there's a hero that I would like to mention his name, and his name was Russ Spicer. Any of you know him? Very famous fighter pilot, and you knew him. Well, Russ stood up one day and he said, Gunther, we've had a pincer movement at Arnheim, and they shot every one of our prisoners. They didn't take any prisoners. They just lined them all up and shot them. And two people survived, and our troops came in and recovered them. They faked dead. They still got wounded, but they survived. And so they got back to our lines, and the word was passed along that the war was going in our favor, and we should not attempt to escape. But I was already mindset to get out of here, and I never quit trying. And when this opportunity arose, we never had a successful escape, and I tried probably 30 or 40 times. And by this time, I thought, I've got to do it. It's just something inside of me. It was just bothering me for all I was worth. And so I had two friends that had been on the escape committee, and I said, create a diversion for me. And a diversion could be throwing rocks at the guards or starting a big fight, anything like that, to get everybody from the towers and with the big guns to focus their attention over there. And we had a plank of wood, and we hit the fence, put the plank so we could get across to the other side of the barbed wire fence. And we were on a peninsula at this prison camp up at Barth 1, Stalag 1 in Barth, Germany, and right on the Baltic Sea. And we got across the fence into the woods, and now we had to worry about how to get over to the mainland. And we got a bunch of logs and grapevines and made a raft. And there were three of us that got out together. And one sat on the raft and held all of our clothes, and the other two of us, and the Baltic Sea is very cold in April, I gotta tell you. As the Mediterranean Sea is where I went down February the 9th, and that was cold too. But we made it over there, and we just managed on the countryside. We ran into some nice people. One lady, we went into a farmhouse and knocked on the door, and we told her, could she understand English? And she did speak a little English, and she said, what can I do for you? And I said, we're very hungry. And we'd been walking for a couple of days without much to eat, except for we was grounds on the countryside. And she fed us. And I wrote a note for her, and I said, whoever gets here first, this lady has helped us enormously. Please give her some extra consideration. And so we thanked her and walked away, and all of a sudden she came running out the door and she was screaming, and I thought, wonder what's happened to the lady. And so I went back and she said, I've just read your note. And she said, I want you to have this gun and this clip of bullets because I think you will need them more than I will. And so I put the gun in my waistline and off we went. And we stole two bicycles and rode across the countryside, and we got in and out of the Russian lines, and it's all in my book. It was pretty much a nightmare, and I won't bother you with all of that. But we eventually came upon an airfield, and it too was deserted. And so we went to these revetments, and they were all 190s, and they were sitting in the revetments, and most of them were wounded to the extent they'd been strafed or battle damaged to where they weren't serviceable, couldn't be flown. But I found one that was full of fuel. It had bullet holes in all over the airplane, but nothing vital to flight. And so my friend Jerry Ennis, he was in my outfit, a Spitfire pilot, and I said, Jerry, I'm determined to get in one of these airplanes, and this one looks like it's serviceable. I want you to back me up. You take the gun, and the first German that comes by here, I will point the gun at him and then hand it to you. And so I did that, and I motioned the person to come in. He was in mechanic clothes, and I recognized that. And then we couldn't communicate. And finally, Jerry said to me, Bob, I was a French high school teacher. He said, I'm going to see if I can try my French out on him. And he did, and the mechanic understood French. And so Jerry told him in French that I wanted to fly out, and he had to help me get it started. But now listen, I want you to know the realities. Gus Lundquist was in that prison camp with me. And he was a test pilot that came over from Wright Field and evaluated the captured German airplanes that the British had. And he was just fresh and had 10 hours in the Focke-Wulf. And he had briefed me, and I thought I had it all up here, but when I got in the cockpit, nothing seemed to fit. And so I had to have some help, and this man gave it to me. And he was just perspiring and turning pale, you know, because he thought he would die, because Jerry said, if he doesn't get airborne, you're dead. And so the fellow was just shaking and perspiring, and he started the engine. I had no parachute, and I didn't have a cushion, so I was looking up like this to see out. I got airborne. I didn't even taxi out to the runway thinking it might be somebody who would be still there to fire guns at me. And so I just got airborne, got the gear up, and I thought, you've got to be the dumbest person in the whole world. Swastikas all over the airplane, some second lieutenant's going to nail you. And I thought, there's a cloud deck at about 4,000 feet, so I just pulled right up underneath there to give less visibility to anybody who wanted to shoot at me. And I headed north, hit the North Sea, and we would not dare land on an airfield because each time the Germans retreated, they would mine the airfields, and when our forces would go in all across Africa, the planes would be blown up. And so I flew over some airfields, but I didn't know if I was out of Germany or not. And so I thought, I'll go till I see windmills, if I can get that far with the fuel I've got. And when I see windmills, I'll know I'm over real friendly territory. And I saw windmills, and I thought, this is it. And my gas gauges were down to nothing. And so I circled this one flat field, and I thought, it looks pretty good. I think I'll go in there. And it had a road around part of the one side of it with some trees in between. And I made a landing, and I put the gear down, and I thought I could really make it. And I looked out the side, and I saw a big ditch. And I thought, I've got a ground loop and lose the airplane. I wanted to take it back to England so bad I could taste it. And I ground looped it to keep from flipping. I thought, boy, if I don't do this, I'll flip upside down in that ditch, and that's the end of it. And so I ground looped it, wiped out the gear, and nothing, you know, I belly landed a lot of times before, so it's no big deal. And I got out of it and started walking towards the trees to try and get on the road. And I got up to the trees, and all of a sudden, people started coming out of the trees with pitchforks. They thought I was a German because I just got out of a German airplane, and they wanted to capture me. And so I kept pointing to the road, couldn't communicate, and they finally let me, I was holding my hands up, and I kept walking until I got out through the trees and to the road, and I was standing there with my hands up, just hoping somebody would come along on the road, and a British truck came along. And I started yelling in English, I'm an American. They think I'm a German. And they said, okay, old chap, jump aboard. And so I got in this truck and off I went. But it was the most foolhardy thing I've ever done. But when you're 23 years of old age, you do a lot of things you wouldn't do at 85, I'll tell you that.
Shorty, how old were you when you were flying?
24.
You 24?
Yes.
Don, how old were you?
I started at 19.
At 19. Bud, how old were you when you were a flight leader in XO of the squadron?
22.
22. Gunther, how old were you during those years when you were flying combat?
When the war started, I was 21. And after losses over the British Channel, I became squadron commander at the age of 22.
22.
Hey, Gunther, which war are you talking about when you were 21?
Don, and this is a question for everybody. How tough was maintenance and supply of your airplanes in the CBI?
It was pretty tough because everything that came into China came over the hump by air. The hump is the Himalaya Mountains between Assam and India and China. The Japanese had control of all the sea and land access to China, so we were very limited on the planes carried over fuel and personnel and armament and parts and all that, but no food, and so a lot of times we just couldn't fly a lot of the airplanes because we didn't have the parts. Did a lot of cannibalizing, you know, taking ones apart. But the worst thing we had to eat was the Chinese food was really bad. I mean bad. And we had kind of rotten pork every day from some weird looking pigs. And they were very distinctive, especially the stink part of it. And so we would just yell, Aegis. And they had all the eggs in the world over there. I never saw a chicken, I never ate any chicken. But we'd have three or four omelets a day, and we were sometimes eating 12, 15 eggs a day. They hadn't invented cholesterol yet, so we made it through.
Gunther, Shorty, how tough was maintenance with the P-47s? How challenging was that?
The first thing I'd have to tell you, they did a fantastic job. I didn't maintain them, I flew them. Right. I had the easy part. But right. I commanded 6 fighter squadrons after Korea. I know what those people go through. I spent most of the pilots take care of themselves. Those maintenance people, they work their heart out for you. They keep you alive. And of those 6 squadrons I had, I never lost a pilot. Boy. Over 11 years, and I want to mention something about my group. The leadership was so great. I went in, we were the second group of replacements. There were 11 of us, and we were split 4 into 2 squadrons, 3 in the other. Of those 11 pilots, if you did what they told you, the way they trained us before we even went on combat, you had a good chance of completing that war. Of the 11 of us, 10 of us completed the war, flew all their missions. 2 of us became aces. The only one who was killed was in a training mission. Those of you in Germany know about the WASH, where we'd go out and practice dive bombing, etc. A kid by the name of Roby, who was one of the better pilots of the 11, he flew Zemke's wing right off. They thought so much of him. It was one of these days where you couldn't tell the difference between the sky and the water. Dove straight in. That was the only one we lost out of 11.
Bud, how tough was maintenance's ply on your Mustangs in England?
As far as I recall, it was very, very good. We had a good supply system. I was particularly fortunate in having a crew chief that I had from the time we started training in Tonopah all the way to combat. And he kept my airplane ticking just like a Mercedes. to tell you, I flew 480 hours and 20 minutes of combat flying and never aborted for any reason whatsoever, mechanical or any other reason. A couple of times I should have aborted, but that's how reliable it was, the Mustang, and the support was good.
Tell us about about the repainting of your airplane.
This is my crew chief story, is what you want. Like Shorty said, they were working their butts off for you, and they really were. Think of it, if you were the crew chief of an airplane and your airplane went down for any reason whatsoever, think how you'd feel about that. And these guys really took it to heart. And if you had a kill and put that on the side of the airplane, that was their kill too. They were really proud of this. At our field, they had to work in the open. No hangars for day-to-day maintenance or anything like that. And this was one of those 100-year winters in Britain where it snowed and everything else. So I've always just loved my crew chief and my whole crew. Otto Heino, he was a Finnish guy, a Ford mechanic. And I got him in Tonopah on a P-39, and he figured out how to do everything just perfect. So I flew my first tour, came back for a second tour, got another airplane. By this time, he was promoted to a tech sergeant, and they made him a flight chief. And so he handpicked a new crew chief for me, and I did my second tour with Mel Schunemann. And Leon Zimmerman was my armor. So the story I like to tell about how dedicated and how hard they worked was during my second tour, I got a D model, P-51D with the 6 guns rather than the 4. And at that time, we were kind of stopped painting them camouflage. When I got there, I got a new D, and it's camouflaged dark green. Before that, they all were painted dark green. And I remember we were getting the natural aluminum paint schemes in, and It was getting winter time. We had a mixture of airplanes, and I looked at in November of 1944, snow hit Germany, heavy snow, and I saw this flight of four Mustangs. Two of them were camouflaged, the dark, and two of them were natural aluminum. Well, guess which one stood out? like you know what, in a fish, in a punch bowl. And so I got back from the mission. I said, hey, the airplane's okay. Get it ready for tomorrow. And by the way, when you got the time, when it goes down for heavy maintenance, I would like you to de-paint the airplane and put it in the natural aluminum paint scheme. You know, I'd figured it'd take a couple of days. And they all stood there and nodded. And I went back home, went to bed, come up, got in the that night I said, I was the operational, I said, I think I'll fly tomorrow. I'll put my name on the board. Didn't think about it again in the morning, get the briefing, go in there, get my parachute, walk out, walked up over this revetment and looked down, and there's this Mustang sitting there in gleaming aluminum. And these three guys are just kind of standing there at attention, and I felt like a jerk. I said, God, did they think I gave them a direct order to do that? And their hands were raw. They'd used whatever they could, to gasoline and rags and everything, to get it ready. They'd started the moment I left that yesterday afternoon and had it ready. And I thought about it a little bit, and I said, you know, they did it because they want to do it. They had that motivation to just do their part. It's incredible. And I can't say enough about the kind of support we had from our ground crews, or even any of the other support. I don't ever remember being short bombs, bullets, food, cigarettes, you name it. The home front was terrific. It was a great time of patriotism in the United States.
And Gunther, there you were most of your time in Russia and in cold weather. How hard was it to keep your airplanes in the air during that time?
This was a real problem. You know, the logistic was different in the area, in the different areas, you know. When you are in France, you had a good logistic. You have in Germany a good logistic. You had in Russia a horrible logistic, particularly for the transport, you know. Every fuel, engines, everything had to be flown in. And we lost a tremendous number of Su-52 in Africa and in Crete Island. It's really short in transport possibilities. This was one thing. The next thing was, as you mentioned, the weather situation. We didn't have buildings or whatsoever. We were, I just can tell you, my group was in 2 years jumped to 44 different lawns. These were not airfields. They were selected from the air. It could be become an airfield. And on these unprepared fields, we have to carry out our logistic. We depended on transport from the back. This was short. And the handling, engine change, whatsoever, this is all in the open air. There was no building, no nothing, at temperatures of minus 30 degrees. And at the beginning, when the winter came, in the first winter, 1941, we were completely unprepared for those temperatures, and our mechanics, it happened, a mechanic, his hand was frozen to the engine. Certainly, we took care in the back, in Germany, but this was a problem till the end of the war, no doubt.
When you, after the war was over, you came back, you came to fly in the United States, you and Eric Hartman, yes? at Luke Air Force Base. How were you treated when you, when the war was over? How were you treated here in the United States?
From the war was over, I was treated first as a prisoner. I was an American prisoner, and then taken. Your Secret Service was well informed, and they picked me out and sent me, sent me to England for information, interrogation. We were treated good. There was no doubt. As it is possible, in a mess of, for instance, North France, there were 100,000 prisoners, German prisoners living in tents. We were in like sardines, you know. This was the thing. A prisoner was for interrogation in England, and that was the first time that we, Rudel and myself, were taken over to the British Fighter Leader School in Tangmere. And we landed, and certainly the air police came and put us in jail. This was normal, in prison. But they left the doors open. I said, Rudel, this is a good thing. You know, the doors are open. And all of us, 10 minutes later, a smart British Greek commander came and said, gentlemen, this is my first address, that we were gentlemen. Said, we're so sorry we didn't expect that early. Did you have lunch? I said, no, sir, I didn't have lunch for the last 3 months. Then he said, do you want a cigarette? Yes, certainly a cigarette. I took one out, 15. I mean, we were treated as gentlemen over there. But it depended certainly on the situation. Now, the new German Air Force. So here, when I joined the new German Air Force, this was first January 1956, when the German Air Force became legal. Before that, there was staffs to prepare this. We were under the command, for instance, of NATO and US officers. I started flying. My instructor pilot was certainly a U.S. instructor pilot. And the relationship was absolutely good. And we came together at the, normally at the end of the year, always shy, but then we came together. And then when we had flown the T-6 in Germany, this was the first one, then the T-33, everything with American instructor pilots, then we went over to San Antonio and Luke Air Force Base. And this was absolutely a friendly relationship. This was very reconciling, and certainly we had one command, and it was also the matter of NATO. We were in NATO, and we were fighting, or we were there and working for the same situation, for the same target. And with bind us together, you know, in those days, the political situation was very sharp east-west. And this bound all the NATO forces in the West very together, and we had a good relationship.
Don, Shorty.
Could I ask Gunther a question?
Sure.
Gunther, I would like to know, what happened to that American leather flying in jacket you were wearing when you were shot down? What happened to it?
He's talking about when his guy shot me down. I came down, and I was hanging on a tree, and the thumb was
without
off.
Without one thumb.
Without thumb. And I was so beautiful, bloody all over. And I had an American leather vest, pilot's vest, because we didn't have one. And I was hanging in at this 3 meters, it went down, and this was dangerous because 1 year before I broke my back 3 times. So the doctor said, don't get an impact on the ground because it breaks again. But I was happy When I came down, it was a deep slope, and it went boom, 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 and went up. In the next village, this was watched from the ground, farmers came. And they had their, how do you call this?
Pitchfork.
Yeah, pitchfork. They wanted to come to me. And I was calling, I'm a German. And I was considering that every pilot is coming down on the parachute to sing the national anthem, you know? That would be protect against miscalculations.
Shorty, what are the qualities? What does it take to be a good fighter pilot? How aggressive do you have to be a good fighter pilot?
Well, first of all, I think you have to know the airplane. You have to feel that you're part of it. And I call myself conservative aggressive. I got involved in many situations, but I always had a degree of caution. If I didn't think I could cope with the whole thing, I wouldn't get involved in it, and I wouldn't take my people into it. But it all happens, you have to do it. You can't fiddle around. You either have the chance to go and take your shot. You got to do it now. You can't think about it a while. Oh, maybe I ought to do this, or maybe I should wait. If it's there, you got to go do it now. It worked for me. That's the way it works. Isn't that right, Gunther?
Yep.
Don, same question. What are the qualities it takes to be a good fighter pilot?
Well, you have to be handsome. And no, same thing. You do have to be aggressive and use your brains. Don't kill yourself for no reason. But we always attacked the Japanese whenever we saw them. And we're always hoping to meet them so we could fight them in the air. There weren't that as much air combat in China as there were in the other theaters. But there was, at least by the time I got there, they had wiped out a lot of them. But they could maneuver so much you couldn't believe it. They would... You start to shoot at them, and they just weren't there. They would, so we didn't try to turn with them because you couldn't do that. So we just made fast passes, and we had a lot of. We really didn't like the Japanese at all. We were really very anxious to shoot as many as we could. We did an awful lot of ground strafing, and dropped parafrags, which are really neat. They come down and they wipe everybody out, and they're. And you just dropped from about 50 feet, so it was a lot of fun, too.
Bud, what are the qualities?
Dave, could I say one thing?
Yes,
I want to tell a story about Gunter. I used to moderate a lot of lectures when Gunter was talking. And one time I said to the audience, when you fire the cannon in the P-38 and the P-63, you get a bit of smoke in the cockpit. And I said then, I said that to the audience, and I said, General Wall, when you fire that cannon in a 109, do you get smoke in the cockpit? He said, no, if you do it right, the other guy gets smoke in the cockpit.
Bud, what's it take? What are the qualities of a good fighter pilot?
Well, I would agree. Well, you had to know how to drink whiskey pretty well, too. I know that.
Old crow.
Whatever. the way I look at it, you got all these qualities. You got to be aggressive. You got to know your systems. You got to know tactics. You got to do this. You got to do that. I put it on the terms of suppose you had two guys, same age, same physical condition, same kind of training, and pretty equivalent equipment. What made the difference between a good fighter pilot and a real fighter pilot? And I think it comes down to, you can call it what you want, a fighting spirit or whatever, something inside, something motivational. I call it motivation. And you certainly had to want to do it. I think it's motivation or fighting spirit or whatever you want to call it.
Gunther, but yes, sure.
You all missed one thing. Fighter pilots always have to have a good-looking woman.
How much respect did you have, Gunther, for the pilots you fought against, and how much respect did you guys have for the German pilots, especially?
Starting with the beginning, you know, in France, they were not a very important power, Air Force. The French, with the stable and steady strategy, didn't bear much importance to the Air Force. So pretty soon it was over. The first enemy we really took serious is for the British. This was a Spitfire. This was the Thunderbolt, and a very good system to control and lead them from the ground, no doubt. We didn't have very much respect for the Russians at the beginning. But it has to be said that the Russians, in spite of their tremendous losses, they didn't give up. They changed, they were flexible enough, they got good airplanes, and they came up to absolutely the same level as we had. So I think time has changed, depends, respected fighter force is first the aircraft, then the pilot also. What pilots do they have? Are the pilots aggressive, flexible? They must have ideas. And this is important, and if this is all together, then you have the respect for these because they are dangerous enemies, there's no doubt.
Gentlemen, thank you, Bud, Don, Bob Hoover, Shorty Rankin, Gunter Rohl. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.